This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 103.5.
It's Thursday night. We're getting towards the tail end of January, and it's already had 4,200 days this month. Hopefully your paycheck arrives today or tomorrow. This is Nova 103.5, and it's the Business Report. My name is Gary Strubel, and welcome to it. We've got a big show for you tonight. We're going to go off to Dubai and catch up with the Namibian Pavilion at the World Expo. We'll talk about the industry of hunting, a topic that raises so many emotions. We'll also delve into the dark, deep, murky world of politics, where the Investment Promotions Facilitation Bill was revoked last year, and we talk to IPRA, who published a report this week on that particular action. And Melvin Angula's in the spotlight, the man from MTC who's making lots and lots of things happen. So, an exciting show, but first up, it's the Biz News Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of Biz News.
The Standing Committee on Public Accounts is conducting its own probe into public fund misappropriation allegations against the ANC, which surfaced in a leaked audio recording, even though the matter has already been referred to the public protector. The committee believes that the comments only reflect a part of the discussion that was captured in the clip, and that the publicly available portion has far-reaching implications. On Tuesday evening, the committee resolved that it was necessary for the committee to conduct its own probe. In the clip, someone who sounds like President Cyril Ramaphosa can be heard admitting that he was aware that the party used public funds for party purposes. The person suggested that the funds came from the State Security Agency. SCOPA will first ascertain the authenticity of the recording and whether it was indeed Ramaphosa's voice. In the next few days, it will write to the president and demand a written statement or affidavit on the clip's authenticity. Legal experts warn that the National Prosecuting Authority does not have the capacity to deal with all the PPE corruption cases coming its way, given that it is already struggling with the caseload related to state capture. The Special Investigation Unit has published its final report on COVID-19 PPE corruption, finding that 68% of the government contracts it investigated were irregular. 386 people had been referred to the NPA for prosecution following the investigations. Accountability Now Director Advocate Paul Hoffman says that the NPA lacks capacity, and this is a failing of Parliament, which he says has not been serious about its anti-corruption stance. Civil action group ALTA has initiated contempt of court proceedings against roads agency SONRAL and its former CEO. ALTA won a court order in November 2021 for the roads agency to supply it with information around tolling operations on key routes. However, SONRAL has failed to provide these. The agency said it intended on challenging the court order, but missed the deadline and the extended deadline to submit papers. ALTA said that SONRAL was trying to delay the process, but has to date not given any reason for the holdup. It is now approaching the courts to force it into action, and said it would pursue the matter to finality.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
It's the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Time now for the lead story. And the lead story is always brought to you by Alexander Forbes. Let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. So our lead story this evening is a story that's got legs. It comes from last year, and it comes from a fairly unique action by government, where a bill was tabled and then withdrawn 2 days later. All sorts of murky suspicions and rumors mill around these types of things. And a report came out last week from an organization called IPRA. And joining us in studio tonight, Evan de Klerk, founder of IPRA. Tell us, firstly, a little bit about IPRA.
IPRA is a voluntary association funded by members, individuals and corporates in Namibia. We focus on research on policy with the aim of improving our policy environment to have pro-growth economic stability and private sector growth to enable job creation and reduction of poverty.
So feds call you a watchdog. You're out there to have a look on behalf of the population as to what's going on as an independent party.
I guess so, yes.
Okay, cool. But a report, 76 pages in length, has been delivered. That means your Christmas holidays would have, I'm sure, been cut short. All this drama unfolded in December. The report talks about the 2021 investment bill that was tabled and withdrawn. The title of the report, Analysis of the 2021 Investment Promotion and Facilitation Bill. Let's start there. What was your overall concern with the bill?
Well, overall, the bill cannot possibly improve investment in Namibia. It is materially flawed in that regard. It creates massive bureaucracy, additional bureaucracy, and it puts a minister in complete control of who may invest in Namibia, where they may invest, how much they may invest, and if they may expand. And that is, we must remember, applicable to foreign investors, but also every single Namibian who has a business and wants to start a business.
Now, it's often been said that the best form of government is a benevolent dictator. Really what you're saying is you don't like the odds of playing this particular card because it would create a dictator of sorts in an economic sense, but you don't like the odds of who we'll get.
Well, ultimately, if we have some value in a free market system, the powers and control that will be given to one minister will simply just mean we don't have a free market anymore. That's the ultimate
goal. So then investment. We talk a lot about direct foreign investment. It's often touted as the only answer. Why is this important?
Well, investment is important for every country. We see countries where investment dry up and the countries eventually become economically, ultimately government-level failed states. So investment is the only driver of job creation and poverty reduction. And also empowerment, because the bigger the economy grows, more and more scope there is for empowerment as well. So investment is absolutely crucial. We have no other levers in our country to pull to actually get ourselves out of this current economic dire straits.
Now, your report goes into quite a lot of detail, and there's quite a lot of economic information about it. And if you're interested, we'll put a link up on our site as well to where we can access this. Namibia's falling behind seems to be the theme of most economic analysis we see. And there doesn't seem to be a clear plan. This bill was actioned by government and was then withdrawn. The actions on surface seem irrational, yet are we happy that the bill was withdrawn?
Some people appear happy. We've seen with NEOP, which also came out in 2016, that the can just get kicked down the road. So the latest version of NEOP, on which we also reported, was just now presented in cabinet end of last year as well, in exactly word for word, verbatim the format that it was previously. So we envisage this to return probably very soon and very likely in exactly the same format that it's currently in.
A report like this takes a lot of work, Yemen. What do you do with this report? You're obviously giving it off to government as well. You're allowing it for distribution to the public. We obviously got to see it as well. What do you do with this, and does it help?
Well, we target our communication directly to the policymakers. So as of today, we've now printed the report as well, and as of today, it will be disseminated to all the ministers, and deputy ministers, and the president's office, and so forth. It's also on our website, and I believe you will also be able to put it up on your website. So the second leg is advocacy. We need to start these debates. We can't accept that government just will automatically bring out policy that's great for our country. We've now experienced bad policy and we've experienced the economic decline that those bad policies have actually resulted in. So at one stage, we will have to, as a nation, start to debate these issues and to get to a better place than we are now.
And this is what you're aiming at?
That's the aim.
If information is in public hands, debate can improve. And debate with government, do you anticipate being able to sit around a table and talk to them based on this report?
Well, we engaged in 2016 already. We don't envisage government being very keen to debate us. We attended the Investment Promotion Board's consultation sessions last year. And even on this bill, the Promotion Board expressed a deep concern that those consultations and the recommendations that they made were not taken into account. So, unfortunately, we don't have high hopes that meaningful debate will happen soon. So it's more a public advocacy exercise that we really have to go through.
Well, on behalf of the public, we thank you for your efforts. Just a last thought, perhaps, if we just go back to this particular bill, it would seem that one of the objectives of this act was to strip the newly instituted Investment and Promotions Board of many of its powers. What can we read into that?
Well, that's politics that I would rather not speculate on, but the bill definitely makes provision for the minister to appoint any agency to replace the current Investment Promotion Board. And I would assume that the Investment Promotion Board made recommendations on this bill and also to the Prime Minister on NEAP, taking into account that those recommendations on NEAP also had no effect and that that document was also again put into cabinet without changes, that there's definitely at a political level very little regard for NEAP's functions, for the Investment Promotions Board's functions and the recommendations they make. So I think there's some political tussle behind the scene. Ultimately, the country will suffer for that.
Eben de Klerk from EPRA, thank you very much for joining us this evening. That's Eben de Klerk from the Economic Policy Research Association, a report called Analysis of the 2021 Investment Promotion Facilitation Bill. It does make for very interesting reading, and we'll put that link up on our site as well. In the interest of fairness, we also reached out to government to find out their response to this report and received the following response from the Prime Minister of Namibia, Sara Kukungelwa Amadilia.
Well, that's their opinion. I would not characterize the act as deficient per se. Government has a consultative policy in the management of the executive power of the state. So we go out to solicit inputs of stakeholders when we formulate policies and we develop it. And the fact that stakeholders in the public may have concerns that they raise and that we may accommodate does not necessarily mean that whatever we have come up with is bad. It simply means that if we take their views on board, they are trying very hard to make sure that what we come up with in terms of policy and laws accommodates the concerns of the stakeholders to the extent that that is possible. So that is what we have done with the act that was passed, and we did not proceed with the implementation because these stakeholders kept raising concerns, and we thought that there was a case to hear their concerns and try to deal with them. And that is what happened also with the bill that was withdrawn. I think it would be unfortunate if the public would, when government tried to accommodate their concerns, try to kind of project us and the efforts that we make in negative light and belittle the achievements that we have made. That would be unfortunate. And we hope that will not be the attitude that would characterize the further consultations that would need to be undertaken on the bill that was withdrawn.
So the issue not put to bed yet, and I'm sure we'll revisit this a number of times during the year here on the Business Report. We'll keep on top of this story, so you don't have to. That was the lead story brought to you by Alexander Forbes. Let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Time now on the Business Report on Nova 1035 for the Business Report Spotlight. And the Spotlight is brought to you by Saflan Property Group. Saflan Property Group, a leading provider of property services since 1992. And in the Spotlight this evening, a lad who hails all the way from Sivulamunda in the Zambezi district, Melvin Angula, currently CMO at MTC. Those are acronyms that everyone will understand. Melvin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
So let's start out. You've obviously got a big responsibility on your shoulders at the moment, but everything comes from somewhere.
Yeah.
So take us back to the village and the path that you've trodden to heading up the industrial revolution in Namibia.
Sivulamunda is where all my family comes from. It's my grandfather's land. I was born in Windhoek, but moved back to the Zambezi region a few years later. So that's where I had my stint as a primary school. High school, I came back to Windhoek. I'm St. Thomas Broad, so I'm from St. Thomas High School. After that, went to uni. They call it NAST now. It used to be called Polytech back then. Did a few stints at UCT, Cape Tech.
And what were you studying?
Information technology. That's what I was studying. Okay. So I wanted to be an IT guy. I never liked working with people, so I just wanted to work with machines. Fast track that, went back to NAST to finish my diploma in information technology. Then I got a bursary from MTC. So they are my first employer, by the way. They are my first employer, by the way. So got a bursary from MTC. I was one of the first students to get the bursary as a bursary holder. After I finished, graduated, I joined them as a system administrator. Then I moved up. I was helping the engineers in terms of putting up towers, sites. I was very interested in that. And one of my managers was like, "Hey, look, I see you're more interested in engineering than you are in IT. Would you want to join my team and become one of our optimization guys?" And I was like, "Oh, wow, I would love to do that." Then I became the one of the first ever in, because MTC is the first ever to launch 3G in the whole of Africa. So I was one of the team who became the first ever 3G engineers. And the beautiful thing about that is that's when engineering and IT started blending together. Yes. The way it became in
the analog and the digital.
Exactly. So I knew about digital and I knew about analog. And that's why they always say opportunity is always about luck and timing. So that's where I trajected into this career. A few years doing that, did it brilliantly. I was mentored by very great guys, very, very strong guys, Hannes van der Merwe, Andrew Monderu, who's now at Telecom. The new operator came in, the new competitor, and immediately they poached me from MTC.
Okay.
They gave me an offer that couldn't refuse, and at that young age, I became a manager. So I think I was 23, 24 years old, and I was managing a fleet of about maybe 200 contractors at the time. It was a big deal.
Wow.
I learned a lot, yeah. So I got to partner up with the likes of Nokia, Siemens, and I worked at that stint for a while. Then immediately after that, I decided to want to go to entrepreneurship. I don't know why I did that.
Grass is always greener.
I know. I like fashion. So my mom owned a fashion store. She used to sell clothes. We used to import stores. That's what paid for my school before I got a bursary. So I literally used to walk around university with a big bag and selling G-Unit clothes and tops and bikinis for women. So I like fashion. And I decided to open up a retail store. The retail store was called Urban Legend. It was one of the best stores, I think, in Windhoek at the time.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of hip-hop, did a lot of urban clothing. I supported local street brand designers. So I did that stint for a couple of years, opened up 2-3 shops. It was doing very well. And then immediately after that, I got a call from a guy called Stanley Shanapinda, and I was like, "Who's this guy?" And he's like, "No, I needed to have a chat with you and whatnot." And then he was like, "Look, we're currently busy starting up this new entity, this new regulator called CRAN. I want you to be part of the initiation team." And I was like, "Oh, wow. So we're going to be the guy who starts that up." So I went and consulted for CRAN. I was consulting on the engineering space. So we're doing everything from developing regulations around how telecommunications works, how exactly the radio works as well, radio frequencies and all that type of stuff. The consultancy turned into a permanent job, and I literally started working there for almost 5 years.
So from engineering to fashion retail to
back
regulatory,
to regulatory
environment.
So I actually started doing law. So then I went back to UCT. Studied ICT law as well, came back. It's been a great journey, like in such a short lifespan that I had. But then I had to let go of the shop because it was becoming too much.
Absolutely.
I had to make a decision. So I closed down the shop. So I worked on that for a couple of for a stint. And then MTN came knocking. So MTN wanted to open up shop in the country. So they then poached me from CRAN. And for almost 2 years,
than the average rhino.
I know, definitely. MTN happened. Great work. Worked very well with multinationals, South Africa, Ghana, Nigeria. Had a great support in MTN, I think it's Uganda at the time. It went very well. MTN Namibia we were trying to build MTN Namibia up. And then, again, like a rhino, saw an opportunity at MTC. They were starting a new business development wing. I think you have noticed I'm good at startups.
Yeah.
So starting up 3G, starting up new telco, starting up a shop, starting up a regulator. Now MTC was going into enterprise business services. So like, let me give it a try. And I got the job. So that's how I ended up back at MTC.
All right, brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you. That is a long and winding road.
It's a mouthful, sorry.
And it feels, if I can just take something out of what you said, it feels like a big cornerstone of everything you've done has been education.
Yeah. I think it's two things. Education and also just it's not something that I at the time thought I was ready for, but when the opportunity came, I took it. Okay. I never thought I'd be an engineer, but when somebody gave me the opportunity, I took it. When I met the person who told me, like, you need to start up a store, I looked at them and this guy is the, I don't know if people can remember, there's this brand called Amakipkip. He was the owner of the brand. So I met him a couple of times and he was like, look, I like your ideas. I think you need to start a store. And somebody who was that big in South Africa, because he's renowned in the street culture, I had to take his advice. And then when you see people like Stanley Shanapinda calling you up and wanting you to be part of their team, you can't say no to such Absolutely. Blessings. So it's all about, like I said earlier on, it's being out of your comfort zone. And that's where you grow. And I think that's one thing I've been very... even though I was so scared of it, my mom always told me, like, look, where you're coming from and where you are and where you're going to, it's there are so many differentials, so you must always just try and strive.
Inspirational. Okay, now this is the challenging bit of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
We typically ask our guests to pick a song. The world will hear your music choice. Oh, we always know guys are very sensitive about it. So what song are we playing for you tonight?
Okay, there's one song that I keep on playing, like, no matter what I go back to. It's a song called Understand by Omalay. So it's a, I think it's a Nigerian song. So it's those pop, Afro pop songs. I love that song.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Give us the DJ back announce for that song.
What does that mean?
You just got to tell us what we just listened to.
Oh, yeah. You just listened to Understand by Omalay. I think it's probably song of the year in 2021 for Africa. Brilliant song. I love it. I hope you enjoyed it.
Nice tight link. Love it. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about kind of role as CMO at MTC. That is a dominant network player in the space of the ICT sector, mobile communications, yeah. Internet. And so much more that it now underpins. Just give us your average week. What sort of issues are you dealing with on an average week?
I'm not just a CMO. I am the COO. I am also the CCO, so Chief Operations Officer, as well as Chief Marketing Officer. So I'm responsible for retail, call center, distribution, product development, and marketing. So what that means is every Monday I have to get my team together. We have to, and we do this every week, we sit down and say, how did we do? How did the retail stores do? How did the sales go? What did we do wrong? What did we do right? The launch of Spectra, we are now into the fiber space. It's one of our biggest products, which is growing tremendously well. I think we've grown about 200% in the past year. How's that going? We have a huge influx of customers coming in. That also comes together with customer complaints. So also we're looking at that, see how we can handle it, how we can better service our customers. It's an exciting time. Speak to the call centers. What are the biggest problems that you have? What are the biggest calls that the people are having? Which areas have the biggest network issues? So I can speak to my counterparts from the technology department, the CTO, for example. Then on finances, because I need to report on whether we're making money or not. So we talk about how are we meeting our targets, how are we meeting our targets. Is the product being receptive? Are people accepting the products as it should?
So this feels like a lot of meetings.
It's a lot of meetings. So I end up having to work from 5 to 8 sometimes because one thing about it being in this position, you need to support your team as much as possible. And I always tell them, you don't work for me, I work for you. So I'm here to make sure that you guys get to execute your jobs effectively and properly. So, like any job, any place, you spend 8 to 10 hours with these people. They are your family now. So, yeah, you get to have fights and all sorts of things. But I think we do very well. I've got a very strong team, very supportive team. Since I came to MTC, it has been brilliant. I'm now in my third year, and I've had great support. And I think the thing that also helped was the fact that I'm one of theirs. I started there, and also they haven't forgotten about me. So I'm one of their kids, so that's why they call me Boss Baby, because I'm like one of their little boys. So even though the managers are they're older than me and everything else like that, the relationship is just brilliant. So that's what I do on a weekly basis.
Okay. I've got a question for you, right? Because I wonder about this sometimes, is that the internet's now a human right.
Yeah.
Right? It's being recognized as such in some countries.
It's like water now.
Yeah, it's a open public resource that must be there. Every technical company sometimes experiences difficulties. Do you sometimes go to sleep at night understanding that if the internet stops working tomorrow, the whole country comes to a standstill?
Yeah, it's a very, when you think about it, it's a tough pill to swallow. So that's why people even ask whether I sleep. And I always tell my team that even if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, if there's a problem, let me know. Because, I mean, just to give you an example, MTC manages the whole entire country's emergency number, the whole country. So we cannot go off. Everything else can go down. Communications cannot go off. So it's no longer become a revenue driver type of thing. It's actually become a social responsibility from our space. And that's why you see even the areas and the sites and the locations that we are now investing in. It's not a social responsibility because we're making money from it, but we are doing it to see how we can connect as many people as possible because we see the impact that technology does on communities. Yeah. You put a tower in a community, you come back a year later, those people have developed in such an astronomical way. It's crazy. And technology is doing that. We are a catalyst to development, and there's no argument about that.
And I'll take us back to something we mentioned a little earlier around this era of education. There's no doubt that the technologies we're now deploying, that one of the principal use cases is education of the youth.
Correct.
So just give us an idea on how you see your technologies being used to bring young people through into a different world?
I think for us, what we're seeing is it's now creating connectivity, not just in terms of communications, but also connectivity in terms of societal, where the developed and the underdeveloped can now engage, and the train of thought and how they think and how they interact, for those that are underdeveloped, they'll actually start developing a lot more. So a person does not have to come to Windhoek to actually get the education that they need. They can sit in their regions and get the education that they need just by logging in remotely and having to sit in classes, understand what's going on and so forth. That's what we're trying to see at the end of the day.
Okay.
But what people always forget, though, is we need to start looking more on a policy level, enforcing technology from a primary school to a high school. Adoption is what we need right now. People forget, like, as much as people know about computers, people know about laptops and so forth, not many people know how to type.
Just something that that's simple.
Read.
Or read, exactly. You need to have the basics before you can use the communication. People only know how to use internet for WhatsApp, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, but they've not been taught on how to use it to create revenue, to learn, to build businesses. Like now with COVID having hit us, how are vendors selling their products? Because back in the days, Godiva trade fair is happening, Windhoek trade show is happening. That was the revenue drivers for a lot of houses. But if you put that online, they can still continue to do trade. So those are the things that we need to teach now.
Okay, so here's another one.
Yeah.
5G. 5G is now taking airplanes out of the sky.
Yeah.
It's causing people to grow horns on their head.
Yeah.
You're engaged with this technology. I would imagine it's a cornerstone of the next phase for the internet. So just very briefly, your view on what's going on around 5G.
It's a disruptive technology like anything else. There's a lot of fear around it. It's almost like Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, the technology behind it is blockchain. It's disruptive. It's creating a new element of thinking, a new element of regulations. That's why the planes are coming down and being set down. But if you look into countries that have actually adopted 5G, in terms of their growth, China, for example, you look at the Europeans, Switzerland, Denmark, the Scandinavian countries, these are the ones that are all sitting at the top 10 in terms of the best countries to live in, and they've all adopted 5G. Everything is autonomous, everything is seamless. I mean, they're building Wakandas before Africa can build their own Wakanda, and 5G is helping in that space. So for me, people need to understand the technology. People need to embrace the technology. And the thing about innovation is it's always going to disrupt the status quo.
Yeah.
It's then the policymakers that need to adjust towards it. And unfortunately, innovation is always on the forefront of regulation.
So when are we going to see the adoption of new technology platforms here?
Look, we're engaging with the government, with the ministries. There were concerns about health and safety, and we are pro health and safety, so we're going to do as much as possible. We're also doing our studies. We had the same issue when 3G was launched. Yeah. We had the same issue when 4G was launched. It's nothing new. I think now it just came at a bad time, because the same time that we wanted to launch 5G, COVID came, and then the COVID 5G rumors started.
Did you get that for free with your injection?
Exactly.
Kidding. We're not spreading rumors.
Yeah. So I hope we get to do it, because it's a game changer. I mean, some of the things like telemedicine, for example, that can definitely help. Yeah. Or you can send out drones, fast pace.
Agriculture, construction,
exactly.
Manufacturing. Yeah. All areas that can benefit.
The mining sector. Oh, man, you'll have minimum risk, minimum issues in those areas. They've seen the benefit of it. But if we can open up that market, I think we're going to do so great.
Right, we're running out of time. So just shortly, what do you dream for Namibia?
I don't know if it's a dream or a fear. The fear that I have right now, we have a very big young populace coming into the Stanford. So my dream for me now is definitely to get them ready for the new type of jobs. The old jobs are becoming redundant. We need more IT savvy in terms in any sector. Accountants or whatnot, they need to be tech savvy. So we need to change our curriculum. That's the big dream for me. Personally, for me, it's just growth. That's all I want to see. I want to stay at MTC for as long as I can. I want to see this company grow, become a big company, become a very brand that everybody can associate with. So by the time when I have to leave, I know that I've done a good job. Development, because I'm going to retire soon, so I want to make sure by the time I get to retire, there's 5G on my farm in Sivulamunda, in Zambezi, where I can speak to my grandkids seamlessly. I can play video games with them online. That's what I want when I retire. That's my drive.
Out of all of that, my son would have admired most. They just want to go play a game.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely.
Melvin Angula, CMO at the moment, COO as well at MTC. Thank you very much for joining us on The Spotlight tonight.
Thanks a lot, Gary.
This Business Report Spotlight was brought to you by the Safland Property Group. Safland Property Group, offering the widest range of property services in Namibia.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
Time now to look at one of my favorite websites, biznews.com, and our publishing partners. And the BizNews Weekly Wrap brought to you by APS, Africa Personnel Services. We work for you. On the line, Michael Apple, welcome back to the show. It's been a hell of a week in South Africa.
Thanks, Gary. Yes, never a dull moment in the southern tip of Africa, and we have certainly been busy at BizNews.
So let's just perhaps start out by chatting a little bit about the whistleblowers. They're not going away, are they? Ethel Williams is standing his ground.
Yeah, so I think last week when we spoke about Johan van Lochenberg and Thembo Maseko. These were whistleblowers whose properties had been broken into, and it was clear that they didn't believe this to be coincidental, just run-of-the-mill crime in South Africa. And then you've got Ethel Williams. He left the country last year, November, and he fled for his life. He says he received information from a top ANC official that he needed to, how do they say, get out of Dodge. So he needed to get out of South Africa, and this was due to the explosive testimony that he was providing to the state capture inquiry about his former employer.
In other news, Michael, the EFF have decided to go and take home delivery and reverse it and go wind up looking at the restaurants and trying to understand who's working there, and that seems to be catching on to other parties now as well.
Yeah, you've got Gayton McKenzie's party, the Patriotic Alliance, going sort of informal shop to informal shop in El Dorado Park in Gauteng and confiscating what they believe to be expired goods and also kind of enforcing their own view of the world on employers. So the economic freedom fighters also picking up this baton and going to restaurants. It has increased. There was one high-profile visit by the EFF leader to Cream in Midrand, Johannesburg, to go and demand to know exactly how many local staff are employed versus foreign staff. The EFF want a 60-40 ratio. Now, there is no provision for this whatsoever in law. And you've got Tulas Nglesi, the Employment and Labor Minister, playing catch up here, saying, no, we are busy finalizing these quotas that they want to bring in. But I mean, it's going to take some time to get it into law and ratified and so on. But there are plans underway. So in many ways, kind of these political parties, the tail is wagging the dog here, and government playing catch up with the sentiments, it seems, that these parties are growing on the ground. There is what the ANC at least considers the trap of anti-African sentiment that's being festered here, Gary.
Okay, so uncertainty, and we see more uncertainty in global trading as well. It's been a fairly choppy week into the year, and things are all over the place on the international markets.
Yeah, all indices down at least 3%. But then, you know, you had that on Monday, you had that incredible almost bungee jump day, the market's doing all kinds of things, but ending in the green. And then yesterday you had the chairman of the Fed, Jerome Powell, making sort of hawkish midweek speech, spooking markets around the world, and indicating that the taps are finally, it seems, going to be closed on quantitative easing and, preparing the U.S. and the rest of the world for possible interest rate hikes in March. And the markets are factoring that in.
And just lastly, as we take a look at even more interesting stuff, it seems now we're moving from tech being outsized valuations into food delivery. And a platform in India called Swiggy has seen its valuation balloon. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you've got Process and you've got Naspers. So that sort of influence, they are shareholders in this giant food delivery company in India called Swiggy. Yeah, 6 months ago, it was valued at $5.5 billion. It's jumped to $10.7 billion. Now, that doubling in valuation in a mere 6 months, when the rest of its peers are losing significant market value. So my colleague Justin Rowe Roberts, and you know, delved into how on earth this is taking place. So he had a look at Zomato, DoorDash, Deliveroo. These are sort of the peers within that group, and how on earth it is that at a time when everybody's dropping market share, you've got Swiggy that is doubling. It's quite remarkable.
All of those stories and more on the biznews.com website. Michael Hopp, thank you very much for speaking to us today, and we'll chat soon.
Cheers, Gary. Thank you.
This BizNews Weekly Wrap brought to you by APS, Africa Personnel Services. We work for you.
Gary Struble on the Business Report.
This is the Business Report on Nova 103.5, and it's now time for the Market Watch. The Market Watch brought to you by Express Credit. Money when you need it most. Now, an interesting topic this evening, hunting, one that evokes emotions of all sorts on both sides of the spectrum, and certainly when you go to social media. So we thought we'd have a look at the hunting industry. It's intricately tied into tourism in Namibia as well. Leading scientists have warned that global conservation is being undermined by celebrity power. That's after they suffered death threats and abuse in a hostile dispute over trophy hunting. Speaking to Britain's The Guardian newspaper, the scientists said that poor political decision-making and abuse directed at them are being fueled by what they describe as myths driven by emotion and morality that ignore critical facts, warning that well-meaning but ill-informed campaigning on the emotive issue risks imperiling millions of acres of wildlife habitat and African livelihoods. And I think in short terms what that means is that there is an economic argument behind trophy hunting that drives conservation, and this has long been the horn being blown by the professional hunting industry. So tonight we thought we'd talk directly to that industry and have a look at that particular market. And Yuffie Lamprecht, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your role and why you would be a spokesperson for that particular industry.
I've always been very outspoken about the trophy hunting industry, having come from the roots of trophy hunting, being second generation professional hunter, owning my own safari company, both trophy hunting, what we call now conservation hunting, which is more the accepted term, and then also having a photographic company, being a professional photographer too. I've got stakes in all parts of Namibia's wild places and wildlife, and care deeply about the continuance of it being the way it is, undisturbed and beautiful, as our forefathers and our current government is looking after it so well. You know, the first world dictating how the third world, Africa, as they see us, is to utilize regulate us in the third world to utilize these wonderful creatures and spaces that we've preserved is absolutely preposterous. We know how best to manage these areas and this wildlife. And what these scientists have said, I'm sure, I haven't read the article, but they've said that trophy hunting has a place, as does photo tourism. We need to keep these wild places wild.
They're effectively arguing that without the commercial aspect of hunting, that the need to keep these areas pristine for the Western world will disappear.
Correct.
And, and therefore, it drives a much greater need in that, you know, beyond tourism into this space. So let's get into the debate a little bit about the consequences and need for trophy hunting specifically. Do you agree that the financial implications outweigh the possible negative impacts it might have on wildlife?
Absolutely. When one looks at photographic tourism and tourism in general, people are spending 2 to 3 days in one location and then hopping in their rental car, or jumping on a plane, and moving on to the next. A trophy hunter spends between 10 and 14 days in an area and really invests time in exploring larger areas than a photographic tourist would. Let's use an example as of Mahungu Park in the Okavango Delta, the northern Okavango Delta. A photographic tourist cruises down the waterfront for 2 days, sees his elephant, sees his buffalo, sees his hippo, sees his crocodile, and he moves on. A trophy hunter would spend 10 to 14 days there, and then the financial implication of that hunter being there is 5 to 10 times that of a photographic tourist. So he's spending a lot more money in those wild places and on that wildlife, while also harvesting animals, leaving a lot more money on the ground, and then leaving a product of protein for the local communities and for the staff members in the camps and so on. So if one looks at just at the environmental impact of hunting is minuscule compared to 5.1 5 or 10 times bigger lodges to generate exactly the same revenue to see the same animals. And the tourists leave trash, utilize water and so on, use fossil fuels. The trophy hunter leaves a product of protein.
How big is this industry? And I mean, how? I guess the question I'm trying to get is, how important is this debate anyway in a Namibian context? Is this a real industry?
It's a huge industry. We've got 5,000 conservation hunters coming to Namibia every year, and about 23,000 animals are harvested, or 4.6 animals per conservation hunter. So when one converts that into money, we're looking at about $500 million Namibian dollar industry, just with 5,000 hunters coming to Namibia annually.
Those 23,000 units of the animals that are harvested, put that in context for us in terms of overall populations.
Overall populations come and go. With the drought of the last 2 years, wildlife numbers have plummeted in a lot of areas. But wildlife numbers are now back to where they were in the 30s and 40s, is what the scientists are saying. In the 60s, there was a huge decrease in wildlife making place for domestic stock. And then once trophy hunting became the norm again and became more popular, people and farmers started looking after wildlife on private land where they were already being looked after in national parks. So numbers in Namibia have increased tenfold as from their previous numbers, again, due to commercial farming. Drought has its own way of controlling numbers. And that over drought, we have very, very little influence. But the numbers are sustainable. And sustainable hunting is what trophy hunting is in Namibia. We can only harvest old male animals. That's the goal of trophy hunting specifically. This is not cull hunting. This is not poaching. This is legal, regulated hunting with hunting permits. Everything that's done is done in a legal manner. And our Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism does a wonderful job of making sure that the offtake is sustainable, that it's below the population growth, so the population of every species that's hunted increases year on year. And those numbers do not go down, but in fact go up. And the value that we're giving these animals make those numbers go up year on year.
Just give us a sense of the impact of COVID on the hunting industry.
Devastating. We have had complete cancellation throughout the industry with the first year of COVID. Most of us were sitting at home for the first 6 months. My wife and I joke and say, I've never been home for that long in our marriage, and I got really spent 6 months with my children. There was absolutely no international hunters coming in. We did fortunately have some local hunters that were interested in hunting that we could hunt with them at a discounted rate. But as the industry at large, it was devastating financially that these hunters have cancelled and postponed their hunts. So hunts got postponed from 2020 then to 2021. Then we got some hunters in. We had lockdown again. Those hunts then got postponed to 2022. So it's really been very difficult and financially crippling to the hunting industry as a whole. I can't say that anyone was spared COVID, as was all of tourism and the economy of Namibia.
So this is obviously a year in which you're hoping for recovery. And just to state the obvious, the vast majority of trophy hunting is direct foreign investment. It's foreign currency coming into the country and staying here and being redistributed. So it has economic importance to the country as well. Perhaps just another question would be, given the emotive element of the debate and the arguments that underpin it, in other words, if there's commercial interest, people will spend money and invest money on keeping animals alive because there's a motive for it. Are there other ways that this could potentially be achieved? And how's that? If there are other ways, how do we integrate that into the space?
We come back to the argument, if it pays, it stays. And this is an argument that has been hunters' cry for the last decade. And paying for trophy hunting keeps giant, giant portions of Namibia and Africa open and wild. If we take the value away from these areas and this wildlife, that wildlife will be destroyed. Those forests will be timbered. They'll be prospecting for mining. Crop fields will be put up, and then there'll be no space for this wildlife. Hunting keeps giant millions and millions of hectares in Namibia and around Africa open, pristine, and lets wildlife prosper. If we take that value away, there will be no more wildlife in the size and number that we see it now, and also the wild places will shrink and disappear.
If we just lastly, prospects for this industry in Namibia, how do you guys see the next 5 or 10 years playing out?
For this year specifically, there's a hesitancy in the market for sure. People are unsure about lockdowns and so on. So as Namibians, we need to portray as positive an impact as we can, positive an image as we can about Namibia, our positivity, our COVID numbers going down, the safety getting here, how organized we are. We were just voted the healthiest city in the world, Windhoek. And these are things that in Africa, excuse me. And these are things that we need the international world to, they must know that when they get here, they'll probably be safer than they are at home. The next 5 to 10 years, as long as COVID stays away and other big pandemics, I see this industry staying constant and growing. The interest in Namibia, we are now Africa's most popular hunting destination. And Namibia must just keep on doing what we've been doing and keep the positive image. Government must keep on doing what they're doing with regards to positive outlook towards COVID, keeping the borders open, no talk of lockdowns, and that way we can keep the tourists coming in and keep tourism and hunting going strong, prospering for the wildlife and the wild places' sake.
The hunting industry open for business and with a big economic argument behind them. It's, I'm sure, a debate that will still continue to rumble in the various spaces. That's Leofie Lamprecht just talking on behalf of the Namibian hunting industry. And that's our Market Watch here on Nova 103.5. Market Watch brought to you by Express Credit. Money when you need it most.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 103.5.
Getting back to our earlier theme of trade and investment, we got hold of Catherine Chapushu, Senior Manager, Marketing, Branding and Communications at the Namibia Investment Promotion and Development Board, to find out how things are going at the Namibian Pavilion at the Dubai Expo 2020.
As a country, we are well on our way to achieving the goals that were set for the Expo. Some of the achievements that we can highlight as we've crossed the halfway mark of the Expo is that Namibia has so far recorded a total of 123 investment leads, and this is against a target of 10 leads per month. In terms of visitors, the Namibian Pavilion has already welcomed close to 150,000 visitors, and this number is growing on a daily basis. As we prepare to wrap up our Expo journey within the next 2 months, we have lined up several events to promote Namibia as an attractive investment destination. And these include the much anticipated Namibia Investment Conference taking place on the 23rd of March, the Namibian National Day celebrations, and the Namibian Big Braai in Dubai, all taking place in March as well.
We also spoke to Kalipi Yambilietu, the co-founder of Lefa Passenger Transportation Service, who shared with us his experience of attending the Expo.
I just returned from an inspiring tour of Expo 2020 Dubai, facilitated and sponsored by NIPDV and Startup Namibia. The Expo in terms of international events is only distantly rivaled in magnitude by the Olympics and the FIFA World Cup. This concentration of human ingenuity is an opportunity for 192 countries to come together in a showcase of innovative solutions for the most pressing global challenges. It was an opportunity for startups like Lefa to connect with, learn from, and build value-based relationships with private and public sector actors innovating around these global challenges. In our case, we explore the future of sustainable urban mobility. We are excited for and strongly believe that that future is electrical. Namibia is an extremely resource-rich country. I had the pleasure of working alongside the multi-sectoral team at the Namibian Pavilion, tasked with showcasing these investment opportunities to the well over 30,000 visitors a month. Being one of the smaller pavilions, that amount of traffic is noteworthy and points to a genuine interest in our country as a travel and investment destination. The highlight thus far has been the Renewable Energy Summit, which focused on Namibia's massive solar, wind, and hydrogen potential.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 103.5.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. Following the overflow of the dam for the second time since its construction, questions are once again being raised about the Neckartal Dam in the south of the country. We contacted the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, Kalesh Schletwein, to find out what the next steps are.
The next step is to make the agricultural land available. That is intensive farming, where we put a piece of land that has been exclusively used for extensive farming purposes, livestock production, under an intensive irrigation plan. Now, the development of that irrigation land is capital intensive. We must now find the resources to implement it. The plan is almost completed as how we want to roll it out, and now starts the very difficult part to find resources that are affordable so that that second phase of the development program can be concluded as soon as possible.
A Zimbabwean business delegation visited Namibia to enhance business linkages and explore opportunities in imports and exports between the two countries, as well as the storage of products at the Zimbabwe dry port. While a French business delegation is currently in the country to prospect what the country can offer them in terms of entrepreneurial opportunities and legislative framework. The Angolan and Namibian governments have agreed to reopen the Oshikango, Santa Clara and Katwiwi border posts effective the 1st of February, with the other border posts along the two countries set to reopen by mid-February, a move that Executive Director of the Ministry of International Relations and Cooperation, Penda Nanda, says will have positive economic benefits for both countries. And the Ministry of Gender Equality, Poverty Eradication and Social Welfare has said it will convert its food bank scheme and marginalized grant to cash transfers as the first step towards phasing in a conditional basic income grant. But the Ministry's Public Relations Officer, Lucas Hafiku, said they are yet to finalize the amount to be allocated to the beneficiaries on a monthly basis. Meanwhile, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has been given a strong warning by the Presidential Economic Advisory Council not to implement a permanent basic income grant due to the risks it holds for the country and the damage it would do to economic growth and job creation. The South African Farmers Development Association says that the destruction of crops by heavy rains in some parts of the country are likely to trigger food price increases. And in more bad news for the South African economy, Car Magazine reports that the EU has made it explicitly clear that BMWs, Volkswagens, Toyotas, Fords and Mercedes-Benzes that are manufactured in South Africa will no longer be accepted as imports. Looking further afield, Intel has revealed its plans for a new chip manufacturer.